Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up on our show tomorrow, New Yorker magazine editor David Remnick. He has a proposal for Arab-Israeli peace. That and more tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Right now, how do Ferris Bueller, Mr. T, Alex P. Keaton, Marty McFly, Gordon Gekko, Ronald Reagan, Cliff Huxtable, and G.I. Joe explain today's world? David Sirota, the author, political columnist, radio host, self-described progressive, and child of the 80s, has written a new book which argues that the 1980s explain our politics, our culture, and just about everything else in 2011. The book is called Back to Our Future, and David Sirota joins me now to explain how the 80s shapes the world we live in today. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to start with a clip from the movie Back to the Future. Remember the villains in that movie?
Oh, my God. They found me. I don't know how, but they found me.
Run for it, Marty!
Who? Who?
Who do you think? The Libyans!
Holy...
The Libyans. So if nothing else, what goes around comes around, right?
That's exactly right. And I'm really glad you played that clip, because one of the things I talk about in my book, among other things, is how in the 1980s, especially through pop culture, we learned to equate Muslim with terrorist or Arab with terrorist. And obviously there were real world events that were happening, sporadic real world terrorist events that were happening dealing with Islamic fundamentalists. But that clip is a perfect example of how in the 1980s, the popular culture sold us on the idea of the Arab terrorist as the go-to bad guy. I mean, that movie Back to the Future had nothing to do really with Arab terrorism, but they needed a stand-in bad guy, and so who was the easiest, quickest, shorthand version of a bad guy? It was a Libyan terrorist.
Now, listeners, you're invited to participate in this with David Sirota. What keywords define the 80s for you? How do you think the 80s did set up life and politics and culture in 2011, or how have we transcended the 80s? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, with your 80s keywords as they are relevant to today, especially 212-433-9692, or post them to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for David Sirota, author of Back to Our Future. And really, you say that the 80s defy taxonomy. You know, the 30s are defined by the Great Depression. The 40s are the greatest generation, World War II. The 50s are about post-war prosperity. The 60s are Woodstock and I Have a Dream, etc. The 70s are the oil embargo and heaven help us, the Bee Gees. But the 80s, you say, defy taxonomy. How come?
Well, I think it's because there were so many different cross currents. I mean, you had at the beginning of the 80s, there was a kind of backlash to the Vietnam War. By the end of the 80s, polling shows that we were the military was the most central, respected institution in our country. You had this very strange politics of race. There was, at the beginning of the 80s, kind of a backlash in our politics to the civil rights movement, all the rhetoric about busing, about affirmative action. Then you get the decade of Cliff Huxtable, who was, I argue, is the first quote-unquote post-racial, transcendent African-American national figure build that way, which sets the stage for, of course, Barack Obama to use the same branding. And on the economy, you had a situation where the economy, people's economic lives, things were getting more unequal in the economy, and yet you had a pop culture and political debate that was saying greed is good and that was venerating the yuppies. So there were all sorts of really conflicting things that came out of the 1980s, and what my book looks at is, what are the enduring legacies, not necessarily of exactly what happened in the 80s, as much as what is our idea of the 80s? What is the enduring idea of the 80s?
You write about, to take another random example, how Advertising Age magazine found in 1986 that war toy sales, and that was, I mean, I realized stuff was going on in Central America and all that, but that was considered relative peacetime in America. And yet war toy sales topped $1.2 billion in 1985, up 600% in 3 years. So we dredged up a G.I. Joe commercial from the 1980s.
Joe!
G.I. Joe wants you to join the rough and tough troopers of the Joe team. They're pumped up for some heavy-duty action. Those slithery snakes from Cobra may be bad news, but you can count on G.I. Joe to rock and roll over anyone who threatens world peace. G.I. Joe wants you.
I guess you replace that with raise them, train them, and set them out to fight, and you have today's Pokemon commercial, and it's not all that different.
It isn't.
But go ahead. Why do you think war toy sales spiked in the mid-80s?
Well, and the other stat on that is that they reached the highest level of total toy sales since World War II at the time. And I think there was a larger effort to resuscitate the image of the military and make it the central institution in our society, again, after that Vietnam War hangover. And remember, this wasn't just about toys either. The military got itself involved in video games and subsidizing some of the earliest video games. The first-person shooter video game is Atari's Battlezone, in part subsidized by the military. And then the military also accelerated its involvement in subsidizing Hollywood movies. It's a really fascinating part of the research that I came upon in researching this book about how the Pentagon gives deals to Hollywood studios to produce movies, to use military facilities, in exchange for the Pentagon being able to line edit movies to make sure movies are more pro-military, and of course making it harder, financially harder, to make anti-war movies. So it was all part of a larger effort to resuscitate and make central the idea of the military in our society.
All right, you want to hear how some of our callers want to add to this?
Sure.
Listeners, your keywords from the 1980s that somehow set up life or politics or culture today. For David Sirota, author of Back to Our Futures, Donna in Burlington County. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
I'm kind of like totally agreeing with you about the military effect on our economy. I worked for a good company in the 1980s, and it was very much enmeshed in the military complex. And I remember very much how Reagan spent the country into debt in military spending, and there was a lot of comic strips about that, actually. And I remember thinking, what would our economy be without this military complex? And, of course, now we're in tremendous debt due to overspending on the defense, and we still are overspending on defense, I believe. I think we could spend money in other places, but
Donna, I'm going to leave it there for time, but you've clearly made your point, and there's certainly a parallel there. Reagan cut taxes, Bush cut taxes. Reagan did a military buildup for the Cold War. Bush did the military buildup for Iraq. And guess what? We're in a debt crisis.
Yeah, and this is what makes, I think, having a discussion about the military right now so difficult. I mean, we are in many ways a similar situation where the reason why the defense budget, such a bloated defense budget right now, still remains, I would argue, so politically sacrosanct is because since the 1980s, the embedded in our political culture and embedded in our popular culture, the children of the 80s who have grown up, is this idea that the military is the central institution in our society that we cannot question, that we cannot touch. And this goes all the way back to, I want to make this really important point here, this idea of the quote-unquote commanders on the ground, right? We hear this a lot when talking about wars. Politicians saying we have to defer to commanders on the ground. That was George Bush. That's even Barack Obama in the McChrystal back and forth. That comes right out of the 1980s. A lot of the popular culture and a lot of what Ronald Reagan was saying in the 1980s was that we lost Vietnam because politicians wouldn't quote-unquote quote, let them win. That quote is straight from Rambo, let them win.
Howard on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Howard.
Hi, the key word of the 1980s was Bork. It was the demonization of Bork by people such as Ted Kennedy, who said that under Bork, blacks would be sitting at segregated lunch counters, rogue police could break down citizen stores at midnight. That's what Kennedy said, and it started the process of demonization of the opposition, which hadn't really happened much to that degree before, and is responsible for the breakdown in our civil discourse between the parties today.
Howard, thank you. So he's on the other political side from you, I think, on most things, David, but Do you give him some props on that one?
Well, I would say that demonization had already begun, especially at the beginning of the 1980s. Let's remember where Ronald Reagan, for instance, kicked off his campaign. Ronald Reagan kicked off his campaign with a speech about states' rights down at the site of a race murder down in Mississippi. There was a lot in our popular culture at the time that was railing on so-called welfare queens. So I think that actually, that while I do agree with the caller that the 80s was a time when the demonization in our politics and our politics got more caustic, I would say I don't necessarily say that it was about demonizing Robert Bork. I think it was already going on both sides.
Anthony in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, how you doing? I want to first thank your guest for mentioning Philadelphia, Mississippi, and the Ronald Reagan connection. But my cultural keyword is rap. Rap music was created in the 80s, and as a child of the 80s, I think it's our only true American art form that's been created in the last 50 years.
And look how it has thrived and become so mainstream. So the 1980s set us up in terms of the dominance of hip-hop, too.
Yeah, and I think there were a lot of things that came out of the 1980s that would be compared to the overarching culture of the 80s as a counterculture, and I say that in a good way, that rap is, in many ways, and hip-hop has become a protest of art form that came out of the dominant culture of the 1980s.
So let's see. We've just got about under a minute left. So give us another thought on the counterculture. Is there another, you know, there was the no nukes protests in the 80s. Here we are with nukes again. There was, you know, I don't know. There was, you know, the feminism really got mm-hmm. solidified mm-hmm. from the previous time. Environmentalism mm-hmm. became really mainstream in the 80s. Yeah, so all that stuff happened too, right?
Yeah, and I think the feminism part is a really important part, that as much as the Cosby Show in the 80s was criticized for downplaying the persistent problem of racism and racial inequality, at the same time, that was a show, and larger parts of the culture were also making strides, real strides, for the equality of women.
So David Sirota, Sirota, his book is called Back to Our Future, How the 80s Explain Today. And you suggested that we go out with some Huey Lewis, so we're going to do it.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.